Maharaj first came in touch with the devotees of ISKCON in 1969. And then Anna's, you could title his life, funny thing happened on the way to medical school. Because instead of going to medical school at the age of 21 in 1971, he became a full-time devotee in ISKCON and a servant of Srila Prabhupada. And then in 1982, so it's almost the 30-year anniversary coming up next year, he took sannyas, he's a renounced order of life. And in 1992, he became a member of ISKCON's governing body commission. There was 35 devotees stationed all over the world to oversee the overall efforts of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So Maharaj has responsibilities in many parts of America. In his base has been for many years in New York City, but he also spends his time up and down the East Coast in places like Tennessee and as far Chicago area, as far west as Oregon and with the state of Washington. He also has responsibilities in China and in our world headquarters in Mayapur, and he spends a lot of time also spreading Krishna consciousness in Andhra Pradesh and Uttar Pradesh. And he also has one somewhat infamous characteristic.
Uh-oh.
And yes, it's true, Maharaj.
Don't tell them.
In 1976, he also preached to me and brought me, had a lot to do with bringing me to Krishna consciousness. So that was one mistake he made, but everything else has been really good. So we'd like to welcome His Holiness Prabhupada.
I was told to be prepared for a group of newer people because on Sundays throughout the world of ISKCON, some people, that's the only time they get to make it is to visit the temple that's on Sunday. So the presentation is going to be a little introductory, but those of you that are seasoned devotees, maybe you can appreciate how to take our message and present in an introductory way to others. A little background on the title, Exercising Compassion in Contemporary Life. 2 years ago, I drew the short straw and I became GBC chairman. So I had never thought of even thinking of something like that, like being the chairman of this international organization, the entire worldwide society. And it was a very wonderful experience. I was saying towards the end, I think every devotee should get the opportunity to be GBC chairman at least 1 year out of their life. And particular to this topic, one of the things that happened during that year was the disaster in Haiti. And one of the things that I thought was, you got some ring back in the sound system. I was thinking, in the past, I didn't have to think about these things because there's always somebody else thinking about these things. But now I'm in that chairman's seat and I got to think about this. Like, what does an international spiritual organization do when there's a disaster in Haiti? What do you do? I didn't have a clue. No one gave me a blueprint of what to follow, what to do. So I just do it concisely as possible. Several things started to happen. People sent messages in saying, what can we do to help? Is there a point person? And I was sending messages out, hey, anybody out there want to help? And so the desire from the devotee community was awesome. But we didn't have, in Haiti, there's no temple. The closest is in Santo Domingo. And I don't know any of the devotees in the Santo Domingo temple, the president, so I called somebody that I know in Santo Domingo that is a very responsible person and asked, would you coordinate this? And he didn't have to think about it. He said, sure. So I said, okay, so you're going to start getting a bunch of messages from people that want to go and help. And your task is just to coordinate that help. And, you know, Global Food for Life and people from literally all over the world. And it was amazing. I was going to some meeting in London, and I just happened to go through the airport and find a whole group, one from Australia, three or four devotees from Hungary, from the farm in Hungary, and somebody from Sweden. And, like, you know, they were going as a group, like 10 of them, to fly to Haiti. And, you know, one knew how to build houses from next to nothing, another knew how to start agriculture, just give me the seeds and I'll show you how to do it. And not just feed people, but like help them put their lives back together. So I asked them, is part of the plan the spiritual well-being of the people there too? And I said, of course, because these people, their lives are just broken. So you can give them a house and give them some food, but their lives are broken. So a lot of our work, because they had done this before, was extending spiritual care. So that wasn't enough. Sometime later, during the same, towards the very end of my tenure as a chairman, something in Chile happened that was not the same but similar. And like, more resources, and who's going to coordinate it, and we did it again. So that prompted the topic, what does a spiritual person or a group of spiritual personalities do to exercise what spiritual personalities want to do? They want to extend care and compassion to others. So that's where the... And then just, it was the end of my DBC period, so I just like put that on the shelf, and then the Japan thing happened. So I wanted to talk about it too. So I've been speaking about this in colleges. And the first image is a lotus, which evokes different thoughts or emotions from different people, perhaps peace or the beauty of nature, or in some persons, a place that's of tranquility or divinity. And as a devotee, this is what it means for me. It's the abode of Krishna. And in that abode of Krishna, what I explained to the college students is, the Vedic picture depicts this universe that's filled with so many planets of different positions, higher, lower, and middle planetary regions. And this universe is like a coconut. Inside is the planets, and the outside is the shell of the universe. That, according to the Vedic cosmology, it's seven layers, and each layer is seven times bigger in dimension than the previous layer. Sariputta did the math once. If the universe is about 1 inch in diameter, or 3/4 of an inch in diameter, the layers go out several miles. It's the layers of the universe. And then beyond the layers of the universe is the vastness of the spiritual sky. And in that vastness of the spiritual sky, there are spiritual planets, Vaikuntha planets. And amongst those Vaikuntha planets, there's one that's largest amongst them all, and is shaped like a lotus. And that whirl of the lotus is where Radha and Krishna and all of their loving associates perform eternal pastimes. Krishna is the abode of compassion. And so let us see if we can connect the message of compassion to the source of all compassion, the personality of Godhead. First, we'll start with some very straightforward dictionary definitions of compassion. And there's two. One of them is this one. And I just taking directly from the dictionary. The quality of understanding the suffering of others and wanting to do something about it. empathy, there's a feeling, there's a call to action, and it's connected to a quality. And the second definition that's given is a deep awareness and sympathy for another's suffering. So here's these components. Compassion, like many other wonderful things, it's a quality, an elevated quality, and it's something that you feel deep within inside you, and so deeply that it's compelling. Not only caring for another's difficulty, but an urge to do something about it. Now this slide here, comes from something that somebody at a university pointed out to me afterwards. Do people here know what TED, T-E-D, is? TED is a speakers guild or something like that, and really qualified people are invited to speak at TED, and they give you maximum 20 minutes, and then within those 20 minutes you're supposed to like deliver a message that's very concise and compelling, and they have set their rules. So there was a recent delivery on compassion on TED by an employee from Google, of all places, where their ethic or their culture in Google is compassion. Now, not coincidentally, the individual was a Buddhist, but as I just pulled from the dictionary, he did the same thing, only he did it very concisely, which I'm not doing, because I don't have the same 20-minute time pressure on my head. But there's an affective, cognitive, and motivational aspect, something that you feel for another, some understanding of another situation, and motivational. You want to do something. So what he did in this presentation was he took these elements of compassion and connected them to these two features of humility and ambition that are the components, some of you may know this, I've not read the book, from good to great. Some author wrote a book, Good to Great, how to take your organization, a business talk, from good to great. And the great leaders have these two qualities, humility, that is free from ego. They're what they want is the betterment of others. That's the best leader, because they're compassionate. And they understand what the needs of others are, and they want to do something about it. So, contemporary. Here's some quotes on compassion. Personalities, I'll let you guess who the personalities are. So, Albert Einstein spoke about compassion in the following way. Our task must be to free ourselves by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. One of Prabhupada's disciples told me, I'm not going to mention their name, they asked Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, when we're chanting, should we be thinking that the chanting of the holy name is the prime benediction for all living beings, and by chanting the holy name, all living beings will be benefited? And Prabhupada's answer is, how can you think of all living beings? What is your capacity? Just think of the holy name. Krishna will do the rest. But Einstein's rendering of the importance of compassion is, it's liberating. It frees us. And the more we can widen the circle of compassion to all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty, that's like beyond our capacity. But it's liberating. Compassion is feeling for others, but it's liberating oneself. We know who that person is too. Dalai Lama said, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. Unpack that one. Compassion generally is expressed in terms of helping others. You feel something for others' difficulty, and you want to do something for others' difficulty, and that expression is an act of compassion. Others will be happy by your exercising compassion. But what happens to the person who exercises compassion? They'll feel happy. So if you're selfless or selfish, compassion. We know who this is also. Here's a statement Christ made about compassion. Knowledge and ritual without compassion is empty. Now, religion, those who are amongst the devotees who have dealt with world religion classes that come to our temples and they want to know about what our religion is, commonly they want to know what our rituals are because that's what they're taught in school. Religions differ by ritual. So what are your rituals? So when they come to our temples, it's commonly they come for the greeting of the deity, Guru Puja, and our class. And it's not so much even what we say, it's like it's the ritual. That's like they're wound up before they come here. That's what you're supposed to pay attention to, because that's what you're going to get on your exam. What's the rituals? But there's also teachings, and religion has both. It has ritual and it has teachings, but both ritual and teachings, without compassion, it's empty. So what's the essence? The vitality is not the ritual, not the knowledge. It's the feeling of concern. I mean, this is Christ's teaching, the feeling of concern for others. No, ultimately it's on behalf of the Supreme, the concern of the Supreme for the unfortunate condition of living entities within this world. This is Srila Vyasadeva, who, according to Srimad Bhagavatam in the first canto, describes why he compiled the Vedas. And it was an expression of compassion. Because Vyasadeva, as Trikalagya, he had the capacity to see into the future and into the past as well as perfectly the present. So he looked into the future and he saw Kali Yuga. And he went, Kali Yuga. I have to do something. Being a literary person, he did that. He took the Vedas, which were present in an unwritten form, and he wrote them. Not only wrote them, he made them easily accessible by dividing the Vedas and then explaining them and so forth. So here's a statement by Vyasadeva about compassion. Great philanthropic souls travel on the earth on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to show compassion to the fallen souls who are averse to the sense of subordination to the Lord. So the message of compassion, according to Vyasadeva, is to help inspire, awaken, reawaken the sense of subordination to the Supreme Lord. And Krishna speaks of compassion in the following way, but this is not in Bhagavad Gita. It pictures Bhagavad Gita, but the message is from the Bhagavatam. Showing compassion to all living entities, you will attain self-realization. Giving assurance of safety to all, you will perceive your own self as well as all the universes in me and myself in you. The fruit of compassion. That's spiritual, fully spiritual, on the spiritual platform. This is Krishna speaking in the, or it's Kapiladeva speaking in the third canto, Srimad Bhagavatam. And Srila Prabhupada. That is the definition of compassion. One who cannot bear the suffering of another. And very much like Vyasadeva's statement, great unalloyed devotees of the Lord are compassionate towards the fallen, and therefore they travel all over the world with the mission of bringing souls back to Godhead, back to home. So there's some introduction, definition, of compassion, statements of compassion. Now, a little humorous section. Compassion is commonly thought of as one human to another human. But of course, there's compassion of humans towards other species. Save the whales, save the salamanders. I mean, one of the properties that we were looking at, no one could do anything with the property because there are some salamanders there. No one can develop it. And, you know, to do something, the environmentalists make it impossible so no one touches the property. Save the salamanders. But there's some illustrations of compassion between one non-human species and another non-human species. There's one. There's a cat sitting there rather peacefully, little puppy, intimidated. I don't know what that cat's going to do. But she's checking him out. What's he going to do? But he's tired, and they're showing compassion to one another. I guess it's a dove, little baby monkey. Normally don't think of giraffes being very compassionate, but here's one. And the squirrel accepting the compassion of the giraffe. Has a little baby puppy. And the mother hen sitting on the baby puppy. Neglecting her own little chick. Making safe the little puppy. I don't know what species this one is, but you know, they're on the lookout for some danger, and he's right there helping them out, making sure everything's okay. But compassion isn't something that always prevails. Sometimes it goes the other way. So we want to avoid going the other direction. Now this is especially for a college audience, so it may not have so much relevance for our devotee community here, but there are especially contemporary examples of compassion. Here's one of them. Is anybody here familiar with the work of Marshall Rosenberg? Nonviolent communication. Because it's as in Buddhism, nonviolence, ahimsa, is a principle of compassion towards others. But it's not just harming their life or putting their life at risk, that kind of nonviolence. But there's other. Our speech can also be violent or nonviolent. I won't mention the name, but one of our GBC members attended a week-long or five-day-long seminar that Marshall Rosenberg gave, and he's like our conscience. Whenever dialogue at our meetings gets a little, you know, on the frisky side, he holds up the peace flag and let's speak here in a nice way. Just communicate the message you want to communicate, but, you know, make sure you do it in this nice way. I've seen a little bit of some video clips because this GBC member gave me some of what he does. And he uses these puppets. This is Jackal Speak. You want to communicate a message, and he goes, rah, 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 and, you know, that's Jackal Speak. And then there's another way of saying the same thing. Then how to deal with Jackal Speak kind of person. And, you know, he does role play and a whole bunch of things to teach people through speech how to communicate what you want to communicate. Don't compromise that, but do so in a way that's nonviolent. And it's far more effective. It makes for a happier society. Another that I've found in college campuses, more so today than in the past 30 years, is a very strong wave of interest in social activism. One of the indicators is this one. I meet a lot of students that when they graduate from school, I ask them what their plan is, and they're going to go join the Peace Corps for 2 years. Like, hello? You know, many people, it's like, you know, right away from the finishing their education to which the career position. So for these people, their career position is just sacrificing time and helping people. Or another indicator is A survey was done about 2 years ago for the entering freshmen. A study was done in Europe, a separate one was done in America, asking students, what's your plan for what you're going to major in or what career you're going to move in? And their answer is, that which I can really make a difference of the quality of life of people in this world. Like strong, like really strong. Well, what about job security? That was the previous decade. How much money are you going to earn? That's not the case. My parents, they make plenty of money. I see they're not happy, and frankly, that generation made a mess of things, and I don't want to participate in that. Right? And, you know, I want to do that which is going to really contribute to the quality of life. And there's like social activism organizations abundant. I don't know exactly where they're headed, but they're abundant. And I've had, like, you know, students come to me after a completely different subject matter and say, you know, how do we get more students involved in, you know, making a difference? Now, how do you, like, do that? It's a very strong contemporary sense of compassion, sacrificing of oneself for the welfare of others and ultimately for the welfare of all. Now, how do you convey that or train others to have a quality of compassion? And in the education system, they're not finding a solution. They know how to train behaviors. You know, tell the children before, don't just blurt out, raise your hand, you know, be nice, say please and thank you. You can teach behaviors, but how do you teach character? You know, the answer is they don't have a clue. And they'll tell you that they don't have a clue. In fact, I was in an assembly, not quite this large, but I was speaking on this topic, not with this presentation, and someone started to convulse, and I thought they were having a medical problem. So I stopped and said, are you okay? Is everything all right? And they started to cry and said, what you're saying is true. I've been an educator for my lifetime, and the Board of Education, we've been working on this, we've tried this and tried that. We don't know what to do. We can teach behaviors, we don't know how to teach character. We don't know what to do. I suggested, do you think it has something to do with separation of church and state? Because character is based upon a God-centered way of life. And if you, like, kick God out of the school, how are you going to have character? You can have a behavior. They said, yeah, well, you know, that's supposed to be outside of school, like, you know, religion and God, and you can't bring God into the school. So, you know, good luck. You'll get some behaviors that last for a while, especially when the teacher is sitting in the classroom. And when the teacher leaves the classroom, what happens? It's party time. It's like, you know, and when they grow up, where's the character? It's not there. So now you've equipped them with all these spiffy tools, and they don't have character. It's actually dangerous. Like teaching a child the feeling of gratitude. Those of you that are parents, it's one thing to teach your children to say whatever all parents teach children to say. When someone offers them something, the parent says, and what do you say? It's like one of those toys you tilt. Thank you. And they want something, and then the parents say, and what do you say? Please. So they can say please and thank you, but how to teach them the feeling of gratitude? Or respect. I won't role play the respect one, but you know, it happens in families all the time. Or compassion. How does that enter into the heart? How do you teach or educate? Well, the Vedas have the system that they recommend. That is, you associate with persons who have that quality of compassion, at least the opportunity is there that you can develop that quality. Sangat Sanjayate Kama, from second chapter Bhagavad Gita. According to the Sangha or association you keep, you develop qualities like those persons. When you have the opportunity for association, here's another important element, that your heart is open to that association so that you can receive that character, that quality of that person with whom you're associating. Then there's change of heart. And faith or trust in that person. The person is not going to control me, manipulate me, or harm me in any way. I trust them. They're actually persons that have character that is trustworthy. And in the Vedic model, there's also a very important component of a deep and genuine relationship with the teacher-student relationship in education is critical. In education, what did Prabhupada say about education? The primary education is education of character. Because when there's character, you can build all kinds of things on top of that character. If there's no character, you can't build anything. Whatever you build, it's going to collapse or be harmful. Character. So that teacher-student relationship is critical for the development of character. Now here's an image that, another, like the lotus, it means something very special for me. It resonates with the very first class that I heard Srila Prabhupada speak in person. And because I was new, and Prabhupada was also relatively new in America, I didn't understand his accent, as he didn't understand mine, likely. So I had to listen to the class, the recording of the class, again and again and again and again. Because I listened to it again and again, it went very deeply. And this was the image. It was the image of God-centered life. Isavashyam, he was explaining the principle. I'm not going to go through it in detail. But to create a society where there's God at the center. This very quickly. He made a motion like this and said, imagine there's a pool. And we gave everybody a little stone, a pebble. He said, can you please throw your pebble into the middle of the pond and see what happens? That's what happens. Very nice. Very nice concentric circles expand out. And then someone else, throw your pebble in now. And it, same, it's nice up until the circles collide. And then there's chaos. And then if everyone throws their pebble or stone into the surface of the water, it's the whole surface of the water is disturbed. Then, if everyone places their stone or pebble in the same place, what happens? No clash. The concentric circles are amplified. So, in the same way, by God-centered life, we preserve our individuality, but those individual expressions complement and amplify one another. So with Krishna at the center, I want to spend a little bit of time on this term swabhava. And I'm sure this audience can handle it because the college audiences that mostly are American these days, interestingly, they can follow it. But it's nice to have a term that you don't know what it means. I like, because then you don't have any preconceived ideas and no emotional things, just like it's a whole fresh idea. So here's swabhava. Here's how Krishna uses swabhava in Bhagavad Gita. It's like one's nature. Swabhava. Sva means one's own, and bhava means feeling or emotion. So kshatriya karma swabhavajam, brahma karma swabhavajam, vaishya karma swabhavajam, kshatriya karma swabhavajam. The idea here is that from swabhava, from one's own nature, associating with the modes of nature, behaviors come out. So if you want the right behavior, look at the swabhava. So here's for people that don't know Sanskrit. Here's a little diagram. Their soul is at the middle, and outside there's a covering. Subtle body, mind, intelligence, false ego, gross body, earth, water, fire, air, ether. Each of those coverings, they're matter, and the soul is not. The soul is animating matter, both the subtle and gross body. Then comes this nice thing called the modes of nature. This is a good one. This is the mode of goodness. It is influencing or impelling, conditioning the gross and subtle body. Then there's this red one, the rajas. It's also acting upon the gross and subtle body and tamas. And according to the impelling influences of those modes of nature, then you get different behaviors. So like the mode of goodness, there's a behavior of goodness that is compassion. So how to train persons to experience compassion? Cultivate the quality of goodness. And the quality of compassion will follow. And from the quality of compassion will come behaviors of compassion. Okay. Now we have these other modes acting, because when the mode of goodness is prominent, the other modes are there, and they're also sometimes dominate, and then you don't get compassion. You get something else. You get violence or grief. So we want to encourage this quality. Compassion comes from this quality, contact with the quality of goodness, and then various behaviors appropriate. So compassion is a trait of the mode of goodness. One example is King Ranti Dev from Srimad Bhagavatam. Ranti Dev was a great king and a very compassionate king. He was a ruler, but he was particularly known for his sacrificing for his citizens. So one of the things that he decided to do for the benefit of his citizens was he underwent a fast for 100 days. So many of us have fasted for Janmashtami, and it's nice. By the end of the day, you're ready to break the fast. Imagine you cast it for 2 days, or 3 days, or more, 5 days, 100 days. We'd be finished. But Ranti Dev, he was very strong. He liked austerity. The purpose of the austerity was so the benefit would go to his citizens. Because when you undergo austerity, there's punya. And the punya can be given to others, just as Ambarish gave his punya to Durvasa Muni. Whatever pious credits I've accrued, you take them all. Be protected by that piety, so Sudarshan will leave you alone. So that was Ranti Dev's intention. So after 100 days of fasting, he sat down for the royal feast on a royal seat with a royal array of preparations. And as he was beginning to break his fast, a brahmana came into the assembly of the royal palace. Immediately, he's a pious king. He got down from his royal throne, received the brahmana very graciously, as a royal king would do, and said, "You've come at a very wonderful time, about to break a fast. Can you break the fast first? Please sit here." So the brahmana ate half and left the other half. "This is for you, my dear king." After the brahmana left, he sat down to take the other half to break his fast. But just as he was about to break his fast, one man came with a bunch of little puppies. And he said, "Oh, my puppies are really hungry. You got something to eat for my little puppies?" "Oh, yes, I have something to eat for your puppies. Please give them this." And all that was left was a glass of water to break the fast. And as he was getting ready to drink the glass of water, a beggar came, poor man, saying, "Oh, I'm really thirsty. Here's some water, something to refresh me." And the king said, "What great fortune it is that one can utilize this human form of life as a sacrifice unto others and give benefit to others. Please accept this glass of water." And he took the glass of water. And as you see from the painting, Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, and Lord Indra, they heard of this, the fame of Ranti Dev, that he was so charitable like this and compassionate, but they wanted to test him. How compassionate? What's the breaking point? Everyone has a breaking point. Ranti Dev didn't have a breaking point. He just through and through was compassionate. So they blessed him that may you achieve immortality for this wonderful quality. In our modern time, Mother Teresa, such a well-known example of compassion. Whatever she had, it was for the benefit of others. But not only religious people, here is Maharaj Parikshit, who's protecting the bull from the personality of Kali. He's been using this club to break the legs of the bull, and out of compassion for the bull, he's got his sword raised, ready to chop his head off. Looks violent. But sometimes some strong action is needed to give protection as an act of compassion. If you're a Kshatriya, not everyone should run around with a sword and go chopping people. But under the codes of religion, if that's your specific duty, then compassion may be exhibited in this kind of a way. Last couple of thoughts. Something that I've often thought about, and that is, can compassion be misplaced? Well, something that I learned in my early days is that compassion can be misplaced. But first, Prabhupada's example, the drowning man. I know, it's amazing. College kids get it right away. It's such a simple example. Someone's drowning, expert swimmer, he goes out and rescues the coat and brings the coat back. And the man drowns. Well, you know, that was nice, but what about the man that's drowning? And so similarly, if we do acts of compassion that are for the covering of the self, but miss the self, it's incomplete, put it nicely. So here's another example of misplaced compassion. This is a little personal story. I grew up in upstate New York. Maybe people here know where that is. Near Syracuse, I say, because it's like, you know, it's like people in Andhra Pradesh, you ask where they're from, they say Hyderabad. They ask a couple more questions. It's not even in Hyderabad, it's someplace, but just because nobody knows where the other places are, they just say Hyderabad. So near Syracuse, but it's in the Finger Lakes region. Very nice, beautiful, picturesque place. So when I was 4 or 5 years old, there was a infestation of locusts, like little guys with wings, and they traveled around in thousands upon thousands, so many, it just looks like a cloud is coming in the middle of the day and the sky is black. And they're in cycles of like 11 years or 12 years, something like that. So I didn't see it happen again, but it happened when I was 4 or 5. They just land on agricultural fields and you can hear them just eat everything up, and the agricultural field is stripped, and then they go to the next one and go to the next one, go to the trees, and everything is just like foliage is gone. So it's like awful. They don't know what to do. So my parents made a mistake. They gave me one of those plunger things with black flag in the bottle and just said to go spray the garage. Keep the locusts out of the garage. We don't get infestation of locusts in the garage. So I was spraying away and I saw a little pussycat. And I thought, if I spray the pussycat, then she won't get any problem with locusts too. So and the next morning, the cat was dead in the garage. I felt terrible. To this day, I feel terrible. But I learned a lesson at the expense of our cat that compassion can be misplaced. Or, as the saying goes, good intention is not good enough. I've learned that one a number of ways, too. You do things that are with good intention, and other persons perceive it in the opposite of what our intention was. It happens. So compassion can be misplaced, just as Arjuna, his compassion was for his relatives, but it was misplaced, and Krishna straightened him out by bringing him to the spiritual platform of how compassion should be placed. Very quickly, Bharat Maharaj is another example of misplaced compassion. Good, but also misplaced. So very quickly, because that minute hand doesn't stop, it keeps moving, I've noticed. Bharat Maharaj, great king, so great, the world was named after, they've just changed the name of the planet after him. Such a great king. And he ruled for a long duration. And at the end of his rule, his five sons received the kingdom. He went to the forest, and as you see from the picture, he meditated on Surya Narayan. He was meditating on Gayatri Mantra. And seeing the form of the Lord, he was in ecstasy. It wasn't just like, you know, little sadhana here and there. He was at the stage of Bhava Bhakti. His hairs were standing on end and tears streaming from his eyes and full exhibition of Bhava Bhakti. He was almost at the stage of spiritual perfection. Way up there. And one eventful day, he'd taken his bath at the Gandaki River and sitting by the side of the river, and the opposite shore was a pregnant deer doing what deer do when you see them. They're looking and looking and looking and drinking water and looking. Fearful. Danger. Just drinking water, looking up. Suddenly there was a loud roar. Probably louder than that. A lion. And she looked up, and in that fearful state, she had a miscarriage. Our Acharya's comment that in pregnancy, women should be very careful not to be exposed to some severe, fearful circumstance or some trauma, because there may be miscarriage. In the case of the deer, there was. And the baby deer fell right in the river and was being carried downstream by the river. And the mother deer jumped, and she landed right in the river, carried by the waves, down to the downstream, crawled up to the edge of the river into a cave and died. Now here's the king of the whole world, seeing this happen before his eyes. Compassion. He went and rescued the baby deer. The mother deer was already finished. And here he was with the little baby deer, with no mother, no father, no one to nurture. So he did all those things. Very good. Kings are supposed to protect the citizens. So he's not the king anymore, but he's of that royal order. So what he did was the right thing. But he became so absorbed in deer consciousness that he forgot Krishna consciousness. He completely lost the sense of the soul and his spiritual journey and the goal. And even his spiritual practices. Sometimes he would engage in his spiritual practices and, like, you know, talk about inattentive chanting. He couldn't pay attention at all to what he was doing because he was just worried where the deer is. The deer okay? One day, this long description of, he rationalized the whole thing. On the one hand, there's my spiritual practice. But on the other hand, there's this little dependent deer. Oh, deer, poor deer. I have to take care of the deer. It would be religiously wrong if I neglected the deer. So I may be neglecting my spiritual practices to take care of the deer, but what's a respectable king to do? I have to make a choice here. So he consciously chose the material well-being. This was the mistake, misplaced compassion, for neglecting the soul, his own and the deer and the Supreme. So much so, he stopped his practices altogether. He went into la-la land somewhere and just forgot. Then one day, the deer was missing. He started this whole dialogue, oh, this pious deer, I've offended the pious deer. But the deer is so pious, probably the deer will come back because they're so pious. They'll be compassionate upon me. And on and on and on and on and on. And the deer didn't come back. So the next morning he went looking for the deer, and he fell off a cliff thinking of the deer. And when he thought of the deer at the time of death, he immediately took on the body of a deer. So there's consequences for misplaced compassion. Now, he got a benediction. You know, the good part of the story is Krishna didn't forget his devotional service. Even he had forgotten. So Krishna gave him remembrance of his previous life as the king, and then in his next life, he became Jad Bharat and went back to Godhead. Didn't make the mistake twice. But we can... misplaced compassion is directing the attention of the soul, directing the feeling of compassion only upon the body with neglect of the soul, a neglect of the spiritual well-being ultimately. So I think this is the last section. The clock is still moving. Is there a swabhava, or one's own nature, on the platform of the soul? Does the soul itself have this capacity for compassion? Hint, the answer is yes. But to get there, beyond, you know, what's going on out there in the world of duality, whatever happens to be happening, bad and good and mixed, does the soul have this natural quality of compassion? So one of the dimensions that's a modern one is this self-compassion, where persons like this Dr. Kristen Neff, I'm not going to dwell on it too much because this is a different audience. This is her way of expressing through her work as a counselor, and I know that devotees as counselors, and I know from my own experience sometimes it's just pastoral counseling, sometimes devotees just like beat themselves up so badly that, you know, be compassionate with yourself and accept the compassion of others, because if you're extending compassion, whatever it is that you're extending to others, you have to be able to have a stock of it yourself. You have to be able to receive it yourself. So from those who are compassionate mentors or friends or buddies or spouses or wherever you can get it, receive from compassionate persons. Have your receivers open. And if you make a mistake, as it happens, because we're conditioned souls, don't beat yourself up over it. Excuse yourself. Don't repeat the mistake, but don't beat yourself up also. So there's details on this one we don't have time for. Last. So is this self-compassion can be just selfishness, but if it goes to the spiritual platform, it's not. That's what the answer to that question is. How to take spiritual... take self-compassion to the spiritual platform. In this age of Kali, it's bad. Manda sumanda matayo. Manda bhagya upadrita. By the way, manda means bad. Bad, bad, and bad, and bad. It's bad. Bad age. Don't hang around in Kali Yuga, it's bad. So, in this age of Kali, what are you going to do? How are you going to find good association? Or how are you going to take unfortunate persons who are victims of Kali Yuga to a higher platform? It's very, very difficult finding persons that want to go there. And then if they want to go there, they're misguided. Too much misguided, having other shelters and bewildered and not and very fearful. And so what's the remedy? Is there a remedy for this age of Kali? Yes. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Kaler Doshinid Hey Rajan, Yasti Eka Mahan Gunan, Kirtana Deva Krishna Sya, Mukta Sangam Paramaj. So in this age of Kali, it's an ocean of manda, badness, bad qualities, very difficult, very challenging, just, you know, to be a compassionate person in the midst of individuals so victimized by Kali, suffering unnecessarily all the time, left and right. What to do? So somehow encouraging persons to take shelter of Krishna's holy name simply by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, one can become free from the material bondage and be promoted to the transcendental kingdom. This is from the 12th canto, where the age of Kali is being described, and the remedy is also presented. Evidence in the congregational chanting of the holy name, in using Prabhupada's language, he took the hippies and made them happies. Just from kirtan, just chanting the holy name. And aside from the congregational chanting, one can, in a solitary way, engage in chanting. So what I did in the college is I just passed out beads and had them chant. Gave them the Maha Mantra. We chanted together. And they liked it. Some are still chanting. Some are enchanted by chanting. So, there's the conclusion. Again, the transcendental position of associating with the supremely compassionate Krishna, who can lift us out of this material existence and take us to that transcendental abode, that's his abode. We can receive that gesture of compassion from him, from his most compassionate form of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates. So back to the beginning point. Those devotees that went to Haiti, and then the next group that went to Chile. Now it's insane. There's a group of devotees in Japan. I don't know if you're aware of this, but because I was going to these colleges, we did a little a benefit dinner at the end of the presentation. There was prasadam, and whatever people donated, we sent to Global Food for Life. There's 34 devotees from Nepal presently in Japan. There's restrictions where they can go because of the radioactivity of the place. But they're not just food. They're doing all types of things to help people in a difficult condition, but instructing them in spiritual practices. That's the satisfaction for the devotee. And giving spiritual knowledge in the language, the local language, because they're local devotees that they're assisting. That's exhibiting compassion or exercising compassion in these major calamities and the day-to-day calamity of material existence. So join in fun. Exercise compassion in that best of all ways. Thank you very much.